This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we attend a presentation on a proven model for creating sustainable and permanent affordable housing as two leaders of the Lopez Community Land Trust talk with a crowded room of local housing activists. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Somehow I must have missed the memo, because when I showed up at the Puget Sound Express dock one morning in early November to meet with about 40 local affordable housing advocates for a day-long boat and field trip to Lopez Island, the dock was deserted. It took most of an hour for me to connect with someone who could tell me that the boat trip had been called off due to the high winds that morning, and that the participants had gathered instead at the nearby Northwest Maritime Center to hear a presentation by Lopez Community Land Trust Executive Director Sandy Bishop and Community Liaison Rhea Miller about the path-breaking models for sustainable and permanent affordable housing the Trust had developed on the island over the last 30 years. And so it was I missed the PowerPoint slideshow of the clusters of compact net-zero dwellings on land trust property leased to owner co-ops, but arrived in time for the Q&A, which featured the kinds of detailed questions about finance and legal structuring that bespoke the seriousness of the hall full of activists and politicians in somehow replicating the LCLT's successes to address the housing crisis in East Jefferson County. As I entered the room, Bishop was answering a question from Port Townsend City Councilwoman and former Mayor Michelle Sandoval about how members of the housing co-ops get selected.
The co-op can ask people questions about their relations with how they get along with their neighbors. They can ask them about hoarding, for instance, because there's a strict, in all of the occupancy agreements, there are strict rules against hoarding. So they can ask people those kinds of questions. The co-op always, always maintains the right to choose who they think best meets their community. And that is based on laws say you cannot discriminate, you know, against these classes of people based on that. But you can. You have a business interest with these people. You may exercise your right of choice to choose people who you think will best serve your neighborhood.
Right, so people can be denied a co-op membership.
Yes, they can.
Thank you.
And it has to be based on a reason. And you have to follow all the rules.
I understand.
Yeah.
It was just something I wanted to make sure that
yes.
I understood.
Yes.
Next, in terms of the construction loans were, I hadn't known that USDA did construction loans. So if you're leasing the land, my assumption, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the people who have the sweat equity, the land trust isn't getting the loans for them. It's the individuals. Is
okay.
that correct?
So my understanding of what often happens with a USDA loan is that the community land trust owns the land. They have a lease with this person, and that person then qualifies for the construction loan, and then it rolls over into permanent financing.
So
that's my understanding.
Any of the community land trust models that you've used to this point not require the individual to have creditworthiness for a government loan or any other kind of construction loan?
So creditworthiness, I think everybody in this business always requires creditworthiness. Now, how you say that mm-hmm. on Lopez, we say if you deal with a phone company, a utility company, the local hardware store, all of those, if you don't have any credit report, you know, you type in their name and it comes up blank, we say you can get certified letters from these people showing that you have good
credit. But you're not yourself giving them the loan. They're still going to have to qualify with a lender of some sort.
Except in our case. So I have to make sure this is really clear. We do rentals. And then we do limited equity co-ops. In a limited equity co-op, this is how we do it. The Lopez Community Land Trust has a relationship with our local bank. We go to the bank and we say we'd like to build 11 homes. We need, it's been value, the construction costs will be $3.5 million. We have raised all but $1.1 million. We would like to borrow that during the, for a construction loan. And then we would like to have the co-op formed after the houses are built. So the Lopez Community Land Trust is on the hook for the loan, not the co-op. We would then like it rolled over, and we would like the co-op to own that loan. And that's how we set it up.
How does the limited equity work in terms of the procession of time and equity?
Yes, so we have six limited equity co-ops on Lopez Island.
Okay.
About 10% of our portfolio are just rentals, and the others are all in limited equity co-ops. So our relationship with limited equity co-ops is a co-op forms. We have a long-term relationship because we own the land, the co-op owns the homes, and the individuals through an occupancy agreement have the right to occupy that home and the limited common area around that home so long as they abide by certain things. They have to pay on time, they have to take care of the property, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, you ask in terms of financing.
So sort of like a Habitat model where after a certain amount of time, there's so much equity that's gained over
yes.
the years.
So ours is really simple. Let's say you've built for 9 months, you've got your 100 hours a month in, you have built up $9,000, and at the time of move-in, you put $1,000 in cash. So you have a certificate, and it says, your equity at time of move-in is $10,000. The ground lease then says you will receive a 3% simple interest per annum on that equity. And that is what you can expect. Limited equity co-ops are exactly as they sound. They limit the amount of equity you will get. People ask, well, what's attractive about that? I am never really going to be able to cash in and make money off of my home investment. And we say, yes, we absolutely understand that, and this model may not work for you. And if it doesn't, please go find the open market, because it's a wild ride and everybody knows you can win or lose big there. This is just extremely stable.
Do you ask any of our homeowners what they think?
We love it because we have security and we have legacy.
They're buying into something and paying about half of what they would pay on the open market, whether they're renting or buying. And so I always say to them in the very beginning, you're paying $1,200 now, you're gonna pay $700 when you move in here, take that $500 and put it somewhere. You know, use your money wisely and make it work for you. Go ahead.
So what are the steps to transmute a rural agricultural 1 in 20 into a affordable housing community of 10, say, units?
Well, can I just make it clear? So we live on Lopez Island, which is a very small place, only 2,400 people. San Juan County does allow you to do rural residential clusters up to 8 houses on 5 acres. So that is allowed. And one time we had a chance to actually do that. And we put it through all of our filters, and in the end, we decided we are not doing that. As an organization, we decided we did not want to participate in that. Now, there were two sides to that. One is it was extremely expensive. Land does not perk very well in the islands anyway, and there you have to have all on-site septic. Two, the county is less and less interested in all these Group B systems that are, you know, unmonitored well systems. And three, the neighbors were all expecting this land to be as it is. So for a lot of reasons, we decided we were not going to build rural residential clusters. So what we've decided to do, if people offer us land that we consider too pristine, too beautiful, too rural. And after doing our analysis, we said, you know, this is so incredibly gorgeous, it should be a park, not affordable housing. Can we ask Parks if they're interested in purchasing this and then use that money to buy land within the urban growth area of Lopez. But you had a question, then you.
Do you have somebody that is like at the planning counter, pounding the table, at the bank, pounding, like, you know, do you?
She's not a great.
Okay, and are they paid? And like,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. But we try not to pound anymore. We did pound, but then we realized all these people, you know, they'd like to figure out how to contribute their little piece to this. And it gets very noisy when a community is in crisis because emotions run high and no one can figure out how to crack this particular puzzle. It is complex. It is deeply disturbing not to have housing for people. So that said, primacy of relationship. I think it is key, and I tell this to people all the time, if you really want to take yourself seriously and you want to be successful, you need to be successful. People have had enough of not being successful around affordable housing. That said, you pay somebody and you say, here's the job description. These are board responsibilities and these are staff responsibilities. And these are the volunteers in the community, a good real estate attorney, somebody in the real estate community, somebody that is with the bank, somebody who's a contractor. You have somebody for your staff who they can call and not have to pay $400 an hour to get some information from them. And you, as the board, you make those relationships work so that your staff people have enough because you can't raise enough money to pay for all of that. But you had a question and you had a question.
I know that you all are using the co-op for kind of individual dwelling units. But my understanding is that in some urban areas, Manhattan, for instance, that they actually are using the co-op model to develop or to occupy multifamily housing,
yes,
which could more rapidly address the housing need in this area.
Yes.
Would the same kinds of funding sources be available for that kind of a model? And then part two of the question is, in the co-op model, how does maintenance get taken care of?
Great question. First of all, the Washington State Legislature just passed a law that is going to govern co-ops, condominiums, any shared use of land and resource. Nobody really understands what that's going to mean, but I have a feeling that you will see less co-ops developed, less condominiums developed. I just have a feeling that that's how it's going to play out for all of us. But that said, yes, a lot of co-ops, if you go to San Francisco, Manhattan, whatever, they are multi-family residential. It doesn't, don't get hung up on the form in terms of, is it single family? Lopez Island is rural. People still like to garden there. People always say to us, you would better use land if you stacked people up three stories and in. And I'm like, I understand that, but we are still rural and people still like dirt. So we have that and honor that relationship for people. But that said, you know, we probably will at some point. And in terms of maintenance, you know, is a little bit more nuanced. The Lopez Community Land Trust owns the land, and in that we have a ground lease, and it says we have standards for maintenance. The co-op sometimes comes to us and says, my neighbor is blah, blah, blah. Then people say to me, can't you kick out my neighbor because my neighbor refuses to take care of their place? The land trust only has one relationship, and that relationship is with the co-op. So we can say to the co-op and issue them a letter that says, you're in violation of the ground lease. And you're in violation of the ground lease for these reasons. So we've only had to do this a couple of times. Now, that is supportive of the entire co-op, even though they feel a little threatened because we only have one relationship. Everybody in the co-op either has to go or you have to solve this problem. And so, you know, it's a little bit delicate, but you do have to actively work your relationship so that people understand that maintenance is very important in this. And the sooner you establish that, the better off you are, because everybody then has good habits.
They can't maintenance reserve.
Yeah, so that's the other thing. When we first establish a co-op, we say you are going to put in $35 a month per household for maintenance in case you come up, you know, with something that really needs to be taken care of.
I think a lot of people, when they look to get some kind of ownership in something, are looking for something as, like, you know, a yard that they can kind of create and make their own, or their community, like pea patches on site or areas.
Most people we find, you know, they share, maybe they have a tenth of an acre, right? Most people, that's really all they want. We have access for them to have more. But
yeah, it's been surprising. People were thinking that they needed their 5 acres, but they get their little parcel of land, and wow, some people grow food from one end of their parcel to the other, and they have all the food they need. Other people just want a barbecue plaza, you know, so they have their neighbors over for a barbecue. But what we found out, when we've always offered them community space for community gardens,
not so much. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because they in their minds, that is what they think, and then it hasn't materialized for us over this 30-year period. And when people really want it, you know, there are farmers where you can actually join a CSA and work there, and we find people are much more interested in that because the farmer is actually taking care of all the watering and all of that, and you're just going to harvest. Okay, you had a question.
What's the typical construction cost in addition to sweat equity for, say, a 400 square foot dwelling?
We are spending $500,000 to build 3 440 square foot buildings. About $65,000 per unit goes into infrastructure. So if you spend $160,000 per house for just a very small cottage, right? Some people say, why don't you build multifamily? Because if you don't build 40 or 50 multifamily, you will pay an extraordinary amount of money to meet fire code for shared walls, etc. That's just our county's interpretation of things. I understand that some places duplexes are treated differently than multifamily, but that's what we live with. So that's why another reason why we build single family residential. And we've seen that change dramatically. It used to be when we were going to build a small, like, you know, 700-800 square foot home, and we wanted to do infrastructure, we would plan on $20,000, maybe $25,000. But everything in Western Washington has changed, and I think it has changed for the better. All of us understand the nearshore and the habitat. We understand things about stormwater we never understood before, but we have to pay for those things that we understand.
There was a time in the U.S. when the government did put in infrastructure.
Yes.
Yeah. And that, if governments would put in infrastructure, it would be a huge boom.
So we, you know, we have to put in our own culverts so that we can access the land, our own fire hydrant. We have to put in all of our own stormwater and rain gardens and retention ponds. And at any rate, it all has to be treated and all of that. So you start to add on all of those things. And we don't take a developer's fee or anything. It's not smart to do what we do. But we do it that way because we live in this little tiny place and we need to have stable housing for people. So, okay, question there and then here.
Who is predominantly doing the work besides the interns and the sweat equity, and what are you paying the interns? And are you providing housing or...
Yes, so our internship program is this. We say a minimum 6 weeks. We give them $100 a week. Since 1990, we have worked out with labor and industries attorneys how to operate our internship program. We have curriculum for them. We have some classes, and we usually have them for 6 weeks. sometimes 3 months, sometimes 4 months. But usually after 6 weeks, if they are skilled and they want to stay, we will say to them, we would feel more comfortable paying you a hourly wage because, you know, your internship paid off and you're now a fairly skilled laborer. And so we'd like...
We try and hire someone, a contractor or a construction manager who can teach. So we, not just any contractor works for us.
And Labor and Industries allows the owner to do their own electrical work. So sometimes if we have some skilled people, or like one time one of the co-op members' father was an electrician and he wanted to do all the wiring, all the boxes, everything in all the houses. So we said, okay. But plumbers, electricians, carpenters, all of that, we usually just pay. Right now, Lopez Community Land Trust acts as its own general contractor because we can't afford the 18% markup and the 15% overhead and profit.
So could you tell me what the percentage is, if you know it, of grants, donations, and all of the money part in terms of, you know,
it's
membership fees.
Every single time.
And so let's talk about the first time.
Okay, so the first time was very unusual. We had a $500,000 budget in 1991. We built 7 homes ranging in square footage from 1,300 to 550. Each homeowner was responsible for a $20,000 loan. The rest of it, we were able to get through grants, through the Housing Trust Fund, through Community Development Block Grant, and through local fundraising. So that is how we organized our first one. The second one, we said, that is exhausting. We had to deal with federal money, state money, county money, individual donors, and a bank. So we said, look at us, we're completely and utterly exhausted. And we said that to the state of Washington. And one of the women there said, that's ridiculous. You spend so much effort fundraising, you can barely get your projects done. And they said, why don't we make you a 60-year 1% loan, and that way you don't have to do any fundraising. You'll just do what people normally do. Take a loan and build some houses. That was amazing.
One time.
And then we wanted to do that again, and they said, are you kidding? That, we will never do that again, and we wish we could take it back from you, because everything had changed at the state, so we can't do that anymore. So then we took another tact, and we said, let's try our local community and try and raise money from them, get some money from the state of Washington, leave the feds out of it altogether with all their requirements to spend a lot of time with paper and checking boxes, etc. And so we'll do 1/3 from the community, 1/3 from the bank, and 1/3 from the Housing Trust Fund. And that worked out okay. Then the fourth one came, and that was Common Ground, and that was in 2008. And if you remember, but the economy crashed during that time. So that forced us to make some relationships with some private foundations, which was good for us. And they came in and filled the void.
The financing of things changes all the time. So we're constantly having to look and learn, okay, what fits our particular project? Where can we make that money? And one thing we've really learned is the paperwork that's coming from government or federal home loan banks, we might as well hire somebody, which takes all the money that we would have gained from it. So we've begun looking more and more in the private sector.
In my experience, banks and co-ops are allergic to one another, that they don't intermingle. So I'm really curious about how you managed to pull that one off.
Primacy of relationship. We established a relationship with the president of the local bank,
And one thing about our local bank, which is probably similar to a credit union, is our local bank was not selling their paper. They were holding it internally. And still to this day, even though they have been gobbled up by another bank, they still hold a certain amount inside the bank, and they will lend us. And they have been lending to us for about 15 years. And because there is zero default, never a blip, nothing that ever goes wrong, it is a very, very secure relationship. And it's good community relations for them. But I think with co-ops, one must always find a good relationship with a lender or somebody in the community that has capacity to do that kind of lending.
And in the very first projects, we got a bank official to sit on our qualifications committee. So they actually took a role in helping us determine how do you qualify somebody financially.
I think it's probably fair to say it's a major pitfall in affordable housing generally in Port Townsend. We don't have anyone who's on staff in a lot of ways to work on these problems. We have board members, we have volunteers, a lot of people who are...
We have to have staff.
We have to have staff. How does that work for you?
If you want to be successful, you have to have staff. It's just because most people who are of working age cannot not work.
Right.
Yes, and you have to have staff, and you usually do that the way we've done that, is you make relationship and partnerships. I mean, we sometimes will say to somebody in the community who has access to, you know, money and cares about affordable housing, what we need from you is 3 years, this amount, because we have to have staff. We only have in our organization the equivalent of 2 full-time people, right? We don't have a lot of staff, but we get a lot of things done because we leverage our staff time. But you have to have staff, and you have to pay them, and you have to have them show up for work, and you have to do professional development with them. You have to send them out to conferences. You have to let them, you have to, as the board, make relationship for them so that they can call when they have a question. They have to have people that are going to review the legal documents. I mean, this is real serious game you're engaged in, and it's going to matter in people's lives how you set it up. So you've got to set it up right. It's a ridiculous amount of work to have to do, but you just do it, and you do it well, and you set your organization up to succeed, 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 and you don't try and do it all on volunteers unless, of course, you have people who are skilled and able to do this and want to give their time and, you know, do that. But I have not really seen a successful organization do that. You have to have paid staff. Have I made that clear to you?
You've been listening to a presentation by Lopez Community Land Trust Executive Director Sandy Bishop and Community Liaison Rhea Miller about the path-breaking models for sustainable and permanent affordable housing the Trust has developed on Lopez Island over the last 30 years. If you're interested in similar work being carried out locally by the Homeward Bound Community Land Trust, you can email HBCLT board member Mark Cooper at mark.cooper@hbclt.org or visit the hbclt.org website. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.